A Katra podcast, conversations for the curious, essential knowledge. Simplify. Your gateway to essential ideas that matter most. This audio summary has been prepared with the help of a Katra AI. Welcome back to the Deep Dive. Today, we're diving into something pretty fundamental, something we all face, but maybe don't talk about nearly enough.
Right. We're tackling death and dying, the one experience that's absolutely guaranteed for every single one of us.
Exactly. And yet, especially in modern Western culture, it often feels like this huge taboo, or worse, like some kind of technical problem to be solved, a failure even.
Mm. And that disconnect, that avoidance, is really the heart of what we're exploring today through this fascinating book, Death and Dying, by Nicole Piemonte and Sean Abreu.
Because the authors argue, pretty convincingly, I think, that this denial, this way we sort of outsource death to institutions, it has real costs.
Huge costs. It fuels anxiety about death, obviously, but it also leads to, well, a lot of unnecessary suffering at the end of life. Patients, families, they often feel lost, alienated, unprepared.
So the book's mission, if you like, is to help us reclaim that conversation, to gain what they call mortality wisdom.
Yeah, and the idea is that by understanding death better, by facing it, we can actually live more fully, more authentically right now. It's not morbid. It's about enhancing life.
Okay, so before we get into the core ideas, let's talk about the authors. Because their combined perspective is really key here, isn't it?
It absolutely is. They bring two quite different but complementary angles to this.
So first up is Nicole Piemonte. What's her background?
She has a PhD in medical humanities. So she's looking at this through a philosophical, ethical lens. She critiques medical culture, you know, how sometimes the intense focus on technology can, well, maybe erode empathy a bit.
Right. Sort of diagnosing the systemic issues, the big picture.
Exactly. The sort of intellectual framework. But then you have Sean Abreu.
And he brings the practical side.
Totally. Mm. He also has a PhD in philosophy and thanatology. That's the study of death. But his real focus is hands-on work. He works in hospice and palliative care.
Ah, so he's actually at the bedside, dealing with the day-to-day realities.
Precisely. He sees the communication breakdowns, the emotional struggles, the practical challenges firsthand every day.
So you've got the deep theoretical critique from Piemonte and then Abreu grounding it all in, well, in lived experience.
Yeah, it's that synergy that makes their arguments so powerful. They're bridging that gap between the academic world and the actual hospital room, you could say. They understand the system from both inside and out.
Okay, so let's get into the book itself. Mm-hmm. What's the central argument they're making?
Well, fundamentally, they're pushing back against this idea that death is just a biological event, a machine breaking down.
Right.
They argue it's much more complex. It's deeply cultural, social, psychological, and yes, philosophical too. It's woven into the fabric of human experience.
And the problem arises when we ignore that complexity.
Exactly. That's what they call the medicalization of death. Modern medicine, with all its incredible advances, has sort of reframed dying primarily as a technological problem, something to be fought, conquered even.
Like a battle to be won rather than a natural process.
Precisely. And the consequence is that the process often gets stripped of its meaning, its dignity. It can become impersonal, painful, incredibly expensive.
Yeah.
So the book's goal is really to help us develop a more nuanced understanding, to reduce that fear, and hopefully promote more dignity at the end of life.
Which means shifting focus, doesn't it?
Yeah.
From just trying to cure at all costs.
You're focusing on care. Mm. On community, on preparation, on making sure the patient's own voice and values are heard. Autonomy.
So the book takes you on a journey then, from the big picture, like how death moved from being at home to being hidden away in ICUs.
Right down to the really personal stuff, like how we grieve, the ethics involved, and importantly, how we can actually prepare ourselves and our families. It's about building what they call death literacy.
Let's dig into some of those specifics. They talk about a major historical shift, right?
Right.
This idea of the ars moriendi.
Yes, the art of dying. Back in medieval times, and for centuries really, death was much more visible, communal.
Happening at home, part of the community fabric.
Right. People died at home, often surrounded by family, community. There were rituals, shared understandings. It wasn't hidden away. It was, you know, integrated.
But that changed dramatically in the 20th century.
Hugely. With the rise of hospitals and especially advanced medical technology, death increasingly became institutionalized. And the narrative shifted from acceptance or preparation to confrontation. Death as the enemy.
And that fuels this technological imperative they mentioned.
Exactly. That's a key concept. It's the tendency, almost a pressure, to use every piece of technology available just because it exists.
Whether or not it actually improves the patient's quality of life or aligns with their wishes.
Right. This war on death mentality can lead to really aggressive, often futile treatments that might prolong the dying process, sometimes causing more suffering.
Which really complicates this idea of a good death. If it's not just about being quick and painless, what is it, according to them?
Well, they argue it's not a simple checklist at all. A good death is deeply subjective. It's defined by the individual's own values, their relationships, their sense of dignity. It's about their story.
Making sure the ending reflects the life lived.
Precisely. Helping the patient co-author that final chapter, you could say. Honoring who they were.
And then, after death, there's grief. They have some interesting things to say about the famous Kubler-Ross stages, don't they?
They do. They acknowledge how revolutionary her work was, but they critique the rigid application of those five stages, denial, anger, bargaining, etc.
Because grief isn't always linear like that.
Not at all. It's messy. It's highly individual. Forcing it into neat stages can actually make people feel like they're doing it wrong.
I can see that.
Grief is more like a lifelong process of adaptation, of learning to live with loss. And they emphasize that healthy grieving can absolutely include maintaining what they call continuing bonds with the person who died. The relationship doesn't just vanish.
That makes sense. Now, this focus on suffering, control, dignity, it naturally leads to the really complex ethical issue of physician-assisted death, or P8A. How do they approach that?
Well, they lay out the main arguments fairly. The importance of autonomy, the right to choose, versus arguments about the sanctity of life or the potential slippery slope. But they dig a bit deeper.
Into the motivations behind the demand for it.
Exactly. They suggest that often the desire for PIA isn't solely about asserting autonomy. It's frequently driven by a deep, understandable terror of a bad death.
Fear of unbearable pain, loss of control, being a burden.
All of those things. The kind of suffering that the medicalization of death can sometimes create or prolong.
So their point is, if that fear is the main driver,
then perhaps the primary solution isn't just legalizing PAD, but ensuring universal access to truly excellent palliative and hospice care. Care that's specifically designed to prevent that kind of suffering in the first place.
Addressing the root cause of the fear.
Right. And all these systemic issues connect to something deeper psychologically. They bring in terror management theory.
Okay, what's that about?
It's the idea that our underlying awareness of our own mortality, the fact that we know we're going to die, profoundly shapes our behavior, often unconsciously.
How so?
Well, it can drive things like needing to feel part of a group, clinging strongly to our worldview, maybe even consumerism, trying to find meaning or leave a mark. It's like we build these defenses against that existential anxiety.
Fascinating. So the ultimate goal then is to move beyond those defenses.
Yes, to consciously engage with our mortality. That's the reclaiming death part. And the tool for that is widespread death literacy.
Educating ourselves and society about the limits of medicine, the huge benefits of palliative care, the absolute necessity of things like advanced care planning.
Exactly. Pulling death out from behind the hospital curtain and bringing the conversation back into our lives, our communities.
Okay, we've covered a lot of ground. Let's try to pull out some of the main themes, the core messages that really stick with you after reading this.
Good idea. For me, a big one is simply this. The cost of medicalizing death isn't just financial, it's emotional, spiritual.
Right. That relentless focus on cure, often over care, can lead to treatments that are aggressive, expensive, and ultimately futile. They prolong suffering without actually improving quality of life.
And you see it play out, don't you? Those heart-wrenching family disputes about withdrawing treatment. The authors suggest that's often a symptom of poor communication much earlier on.
Yeah, a failure to ask the right questions.
Yeah.
Okay, what's another key theme?
I think it's the value of looking beyond our own cultural norms. They discuss practices from other cultures, Tibetan Buddhist death rituals, the Mexican Day of the Dead.
Things that seem very different from our typical Western approach.
Very different. But these examples show how other societies have found ways to integrate death, to provide social and psychological support that we often lack. There's wisdom there we could learn from.
Definitely. And maybe the most practical theme, the one that feels like a call to action.
Communication. Or rather, the crisis of communication. They argue that so much unnecessary suffering stems from poor communication between doctors and patients, patients and families, even among medical teams.
It's about asking the right questions, isn't it?
Absolutely. Shifting from what more can we do to you, the technological imperative question, to what is most important to you now?
That changes everything. It puts the person, their values, their remaining quality of life back at the center.
Exactly. And that leads to the final overarching theme, I think.
Which is?
Embrace mortality to enrich life. It sounds like a paradox, but they argue that avoiding the thought of death actually means avoiding life in some ways.
How so?
Because accepting our finitude, our mortality, can lend a certain urgency, a meaning, an authenticity to how we choose to live now. Our relationships, our work, what truly fulfills us, it helps clarify priorities.
Facing death helps you live better.
That's the core message.
The book uses some really memorable phrasing to get these ideas across. Let's touch on a few of those key quotes or ideas.
Yeah, they really crystallize the arguments. One that directly challenges that enemy narrative is, death is not the opposite of life, it is the completion of life.
That reframes it completely, doesn't it? From defeat to culmination.
It does. And then there's the one that links to the psychological aspect we talked about. In avoiding death, we often avoid life.
That really hits home. How that fear can make us play it safe, maybe miss out on deeper, more meaningful experiences because we're prioritizing security above all else.
Mm-hmm. And this one captures their critique of modern medicine so well, acknowledging both sides. The medicalization of death has saved many lives, but may have cost us our souls.
Wow. That's powerful. It respects the progress, but laments the potential loss of dignity and meaning.
Exactly. It's a very nuanced take. And finally, a call to action. Good deaths don't just happen. They require intention, preparation, and community support.
Right. It puts the responsibility back on us, individually and collectively. We need to be proactive.
We do. Which leads nicely into the practical applications. How can we actually use this knowledge?
Okay, on a personal level, what's the first step?
Top priority, advanced care planning. Seriously. It's not just ticking boxes. The authors frame it as an act of love for your family.
So things like a living will, specifying what treatments you would or wouldn't want.
Yes, and crucially, appointing a healthcare power of attorney or proxy. Someone you trust to make decisions for you if you can't speak for yourself. It avoids so much potential conflict and guesswork for your loved ones during an incredibly stressful time.
That's a really concrete action people can take. And what about supporting others who are grieving?
The advice is simple but profound. Ditch the cliches. They're in a better place. Time heals all wounds. Sometimes those phrases can feel dismissive.
So what's better?
Just be present. Listen without judgment. Offer practical, long-term help, cooking a meal, running errands, helping with paperwork. Not just in the first week, but months down the line when the initial wave of support often fades.
That makes sense. And thinking bigger, systemically.
A key takeaway for healthcare is integrating palliative care principles much earlier in the course of a serious illness.
Not just calling them in at the very, very end when curative options are exhausted.
Exactly. Palliative care is about managing symptoms, improving quality of life, and having those crucial conversations about values and goals alongside curative treatment if that's happening. It shouldn't be an either-or.
And for the wider community, how do we build that deaf literacy?
Normalize the conversation. Talk about it within families, support, or even participate in things like deaf cafes or other community discussion groups. Just bringing the topic out into the open helps reduce the fear and stigma.
Making it less of a hidden, scary thing.
Precisely.
So as we wrap up this deep dive, what's the one thing that really stood out for you? Maybe something surprising or particularly impactful?
For me, it was that connection they make through terror management theory. How our fundamental, maybe even subconscious, awareness of death ripples outwards and influences so much consumer culture, politics, group identity. It's like this hidden engine driving a lot of modern life. That was quite eye-opening.
Yeah, that's a powerful idea. I think for me, the most valuable takeaway is the concept of mortality wisdom itself.
Finding that balance.
Exactly. That balance between accepting the inevitable, the reality of death, but not letting it paralyze you. Instead, using that awareness to engage more fully, more urgently with the life you have right now.
It's about shifting from fear and isolation towards connection, meaning, and ultimately dignity. That feels like the book's essential gift.
See you next time with another remarkable thinker, another powerful book, and another idea that has shaped our world. This audio summary is brought to you by Ekatra Foundation.